The Senate calls out the House, Geohot in more hot water, and a new iPad? All that and more on the Slongcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Slongcast, episode 25. For Tuesday, March 1st, 2011. Holy crap, it's March already.
Yeah, it's March.
Where did time go?
I don't know.
Well, February is one of those short months, so I guess that's where.
That helps.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is Mr. Ryan Lancey here with me as always.
Howdy.
Hi, howdy. Hi-lo. So let's jump right into it. Our top story of the week is a rather interesting one. The Senate Democrats basically call out the House of Representatives and say, you don't know what you're talking about when it comes to net neutrality. So this article from Datamation, there's a couple quotes here. Unfortunately, the House has decided that it knows better what is good for the internet than the people who use, fund, and work on it. They claim to stand for freedom, but the only freedom they are providing for is the freedom of telephone and cable companies to determine the future of the internet, where you can go on it, what you can attach to it, and which services will win or lose on it. And I think this is awesome that somebody in government sees what is happening and realizes that net neutrality is not hurting anything. Because that was one of our stories we had last week where the people were saying, oh yeah, this net neutrality stuff, this is going to stifle innovation. And do you think this is good now that we have some opposition in government?
Opposition to...
Well, I mean, because if a bill goes to get passed, you know, it has to pass through the House, has to go through the Senate.
Yeah.
And now we have some opposition. So the legislation they were trying to push through that we talked about last week seems like it's going to get stopped.
Oh, because the legislation was against new net neutrality.
Right.
See. Well, I get, to me, like, opposition would be...
Well, opposition to the opposition of net neutrality.
Yeah, it's a little odd. I think I follow now. Yeah, I just think it's good that people are, you know, are aware of it, that it's becoming a topic. But I don't like this argument that they claim to stand for freedom, but the only freedom they are providing for is the freedom of telephone and cable companies to determine the future of the internet. It's still their net. It's still their network. They own it. You know, they do own it. I realize the government, you know, did a lot of investment, but this freedom, like true freedom, is no regulation. So it's a bad argument, I think. I just don't like the argument. I mean, I do think that net neutrality is an area where we will be infringing on some rights to protect other rights. You know, people that... The point is to protect the rights of those that that really don't have any voice in the whole network.
Right. Because what everybody's afraid of is, you know, if net neutrality doesn't become some sort of law, that Comcast can charge other vendors more money for using their content for going across their pipes, and that would eventually come down to us paying more for internet access or paying more to see NBC shows rather than Comcast shows or whatever.
Right.
And there was one last quote in the article that was the Senate talking. We're willing and interested in working with our colleagues on modernization of the Communications Act, because that, this is me talking, because that's what would have to be done, an amendment to or modification of the Communications Act. But that does not mean that the agency should stop doing its job under current law. And I think that's a good point, is that, you know, current law kind of also supports net neutrality, in that you can't do stuff to hurt other people. So, you know, they're saying that even if these...
Well, it's basically like anti-competitive practices.
Right.
Especially outside, in another market that you're not a market leader in.
Yeah, so the law as it is now is kind of good in a sense that, you know, it prevents things like that from happening. So it would prevent Comcast from doing all these bad things that people have been foreseeing they do. And, you know, the Senate is basically saying, even if we don't pass any new laws for net neutrality, the law as it stands should be good enough, you know, as long as companies don't get overzealous and do all kinds of crap. Mm-hmm. So, like you, I'm glad that people are now thinking of this, that it seems like people in the Senate actually understand what this means now, unlike before, where, you know,
the internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes.
So yeah, you know, we don't have that anymore. And I'm glad for that. So let's move on. Enough about net neutrality. We talk about it every week. Our next article from iSpice.com is actually, I'm hoping this is just some sort of joke. I don't know about it. But apparently Microsoft has unveiled a new interface that people think might come out as the interface or an interface on Windows 8, whenever Windows 8 comes out. And the reason that we're even talking about this is because of how ridiculously different this interface is from any other interface we have seen on any computing device ever. It's basically a series of bubbles. I don't know what to say about this. Just judging from the picture, it looks like, you know, some bubbles will have your clock and calendar. Some bubbles will have your Facebook contacts. There really wasn't much about it. So I'm not sure. I don't think either of us could really speak to it much.
The first comment I had was, like, I watched the video, and did I miss it, or did they not have that interface in the video?
Yeah. The video was something different.
Well, I mean, it's in there, like, but it's like a split second. Like, they show a picture, and then that's it. Like, so, like, no one even really knows how this thing works.
And that's what makes me think that this might be something not real or only half real at this point. That we haven't actually seen it work. You know, it's just some pictures.
Right.
But just judging from the picture at the top of this article, do you see any situation where that would be useful?
I don't know, like, if the bubble interface itself is what will be useful, or just changes in the interface that we have with computers, you know, the human interface, just to further the industry, or not the industry, but that's it. To further interaction with computers. Like, you know, that right now they're still keyboard and mice driven mainly, except for touchscreen devices. This bubble interface might lend itself towards touch.
That's what I was just going to say. You know, looks like a very touch intuitive interface.
And we've seen a lot of changes, you know, at least in Windows 7. I can't really speak to Mac OS because I haven't been real on top of the latest changes to Mac OS. Maybe, you know, I'm back in, like, probably Leopard Land or
well, if you're back in Leopard Land, it's the same.
Yeah. So, I mean, and even the difference between, you know, Mac OS 9 and Mac OS 10 wasn't huge in terms of the interface of the applications or the way it worked, like with the Finder and everything else. That's still there.
It was mostly eye candy.
Eye candy and that bar, that nav bar thing, the whatever they call it.
Well,
at the bottom.
Oh, the dock.
The dock. The dock. Yes, yeah. The dock. So, I can't really speak about Mac stuff, but here let me say what I know about Windows. And I just preface that because I don't want to sound like I'm always about Windows. But here's what I know about Windows. A lot of what you're seeing on the desktop is sort of a like search on the desktop, and that's probably the biggest change. To the Windows 7 and Windows Vista desktop, you can search right from the start menu. Basically, you hit the Windows key, and you can just start typing, and bam, you got search results.
Yeah, that actually threw me for a loop the first time I saw that.
Yeah, well, I love it because it's actually more keyboard based. I don't need the mouse. I can hit the Windows key, like Command, basically. And then start typing things and then use the arrow keys to select the things I want or type some more characters to narrow the search down. So I like that. The other thing that we're seeing change is the notion of how we organize our files. We saw the first iteration of this in the whole like My Documents thing back in Windows 95 or 98. I can't remember when that started.
I think 95 just had My Briefcase. And then 98 might have had My Documents, something like that.
Yeah, it grew out, and then in addition to My Documents, you had My Pictures and My Videos and My This and My That.
Yeah, XP kind of introduced a lot of other My folders.
Right, and they're like these special system folders. So instead of having to look for everything, the OS just has this default location where applications have an API call they can make, which is essentially just an environment variable, for lack of a better word, that throws them to this location, and you know where all your stuff's at. Now in Windows 7, you have this notion of libraries. And libraries is like one of the greatest things they've added to Windows, in my opinion. You can basically put anything you want in your library, like any folder. I can tag it and say, I want this to be in my library. And then your library is automatically indexed, and then the search results are faster. Plus, you just go to that library. So like if you have 10 locations, two of which local and, you know, five or six of which are out on the network at your home or your office, they'd all get merged into this library.
So it's a way of hiding the real location of files.
Yeah, because we're already talking about going to file systems that don't use hierarchies and trees. They're just basically databases. So there's just a big pile of files and tags to index the files.
Well, kind of what we've been waiting for with Windows with WinFS whenever that decides to get released.
Right, but it may never really need to be released if there's like an ape or a layer on top of it. You know, and then the last thing that we're seeing with Windows 7 and really IE9 that adds the second part of this is the ability to pin applications to your start bar. That's something that Doc has had in OS X or OS 10. Is it OS X or 10?
You're supposed to say OS 10. I say OS X.
Okay, well, either way.
Yeah.
So that was something that the Doc gave you, but now you get it for not only applications but websites in IE9. And I think these things are kind of like all like sort of underlying things that lend itself towards this bubble interface. But maybe it's not bubbles or maybe it's something else, but it makes sense if you think about it. Like these bubbles kind of represent pinning things to your, you know, to your start bar. They're things that are like frequently accessible. And then maybe they're also a library where all the associated data is in there with the library as well.
This is a question because I'm not much of a Windows user, but does this bubble interface kind of look like the things that we've already seen in Vista and maybe Windows 7 with the widgets?
Well, I mean, widgets are,
I mean, I know they're not exactly like the bubbles like we saw in the picture, but they're kind of those things where you have little things you can pin on your screen, quick access to a calendar, quick access to a Facebook widget, whatever.
Right. I mean, it's definitely similar. So, I mean, that's another good example, though. Like, I hadn't thought about that. If you kind of merge in that idea of widgets with libraries and being able to pin the things you want the most to the desktop with Windows 7, this maybe isn't the next step. This might be a couple steps down the line of progression, but it's an interesting concept.
Yeah, or this may even be the next step, but just for tablet devices. Maybe they're Windows Phone 8 OS. You know, maybe it's not Windows 8. Maybe it's not a desktop OS. Maybe it's more for tablets or even larger screen phones. Who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have yet to see because the article does not say anything. So if you find anything, all you listeners out there, if you find anything about this bubble OS that we see for Windows, you know, let us know. We'd love to know more. And Ryan, I believe you have the next couple articles.
Yeah, so I saw an interesting article posted up on DSLreports.com, also broadbandreports.com. You can hit it at either URL. And basically, there's some rumors flying around that Verizon's current freeze on Fios deployment may start to melt.
Really?
Yeah. There's a couple different municipalities that had initial rollouts that kind of stopped halfway, and they list Boston, Alexandria, Virginia, Baltimore, and Wilmington. And that maybe these areas might get further rollout of Fios availability. And the thing that made me interested about this article after I started to read through it is I hadn't really considered this before, but the one of the reasons that Fios deployment's been so slow is that the municipalities have a stranglehold, or other services have a stranglehold on the municipalities there's certain terms that the different providers want when they move into an area.
Oh, so for instance, like our area, Comcast might have said, we'll come in and roll out in your area as long as you don't offer any other competing services.
Yeah, there's things like that. There's also like tax breaks that they'll give the companies to do it. And Verizon had some pretty stiff terms, I guess. That was part of the problem. But I guess the other part is, you know, the anti-competitive nature. Or maybe the competitive nature that they, you know, they're asking somebody to come in and deploy all this like infrastructure at a loss to them, in the interim, and not get any benefit out of it.
Yeah, so, that's something I don't understand. I mean, I can understand like the tax breaks, you know, trying to save money, trying to get the municipalities to offer them breaks like that. But as far as the anti-competitive stuff, like, you know, coming in and saying, we'll roll out Fios for you as long as you don't, you know, offer any other new services such as cable or DSL. Maybe if you were Comcast or Verizon DSL trying to do this, you would want to do that because you know your service has a lot of other competing services. But when you're coming in with Fios and you have 50, 60, 100 megabit speeds, there is no competition. Like, there's no reason for them to have any anti-competitive terms in their contract. They can just roll out and literally everyone will switch to them. Like, they don't even have to do anything.
Yeah, I do think they would, the demand would be high for a service like this, but...
Yeah, I mean, even the low end, I believe Pittsburgh's low end is like 20 megabits, I think. They have like 20 and 40 or 20 and 50 or something. But yeah, low end, and it's comparable to what people are paying now for cable. Like, there's just no competition. If they roll out, they're going to get subscribers. So I think this is awesome. I wish it would be more cities.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see some higher bandwidth option in, you know, in Johnstown.
Yeah, because what do we have now? Comcast. Like, what's their normal? Not the burst that you might get for a second. Like, what's the normal?
Their normal plan is, like, I want to say it's 5 meg down and, like, 384 up or something. And then they have, like, an 8 meg down and a 512 up. I could be wrong on the top.
What's their highest, not the burst speed, but just their highest plan?
I think like 8 megabit.
And then it like bursts to 20 some or something?
I don't
even
know if they have that bursting. That's,
oh, okay.
Oh, did you say Comcast or Atlantic Broadband?
Whatever, it's cable.
Cable.
Yeah.
Well, Atlantic, because some people have Comcast around here.
Oh, okay.
But Comcast has a higher one. That's why I was...
Okay.
But Atlantic Broadband, I think, is... I want to say it's between 5 and 8.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something. If Fios would come around here... Everybody would switch.
Well, I mean, the big problem with the cable providers is just their upload speeds are horrible. I mean, 384 and 512 megabit or kilobit is just, that's like, you know, I mean, Verizon Fios isn't much better. It's 768K or a megabit.
Really?
Maybe, or no, it's a megabit. I
thought it was a lot more than that upload.
No.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I never checked into it.
So, I mean, it's even still slow, but I mean, 384 is just like.
Yeah, like that's why I have WiMAX, you know. Whenever I moved in here a couple years ago, I got DSL and I just paid for the lowest plan, you know, 1 megabit and 1 megabit down, 1.5 megabit down and 768 up. You know, that was the lowest plan Verizon offered. But then when WiMAX came around, that was 3 synchronous. So 3 down, 3 up. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good deal.
$5 more a month and I get upload speed, which is great because I have to upload this podcast every week and you know, I have lots of stuff that I need to upload to the internet. So that's awesome for a very similar price. So any of you listening who are in Cambria County, look up Cambria Connect. You know, there are a couple ISPs offering Cambria Connect. It's WiMAX. As long as you have line of sight to a cell tower, you can get it and you can get some pretty decent speeds, even higher than what I have. I have the lowest plan. It's 3 megabit. But there was some new news out.
Some news. You need to say news.
Yeah, some news, because news is new.
Exactly.
Wow. About a new type of data transfer technology?
Yeah. There's the new co-developed between Intel and Apple, previously named LightPeak, is the Thunderbolt connection. I guess it's, I don't know. I don't know who in the marketing department came up with that name. I think Thunderbolt's lame. I think they're trying to repeat the FireWire, like...
I think somebody made a logo, and they're like, this logo looks cool. We need to make a name that matches the logo.
Well, it looks like a warning signal. It looks like, you know, like the, like, warning, high voltage signal.
I was going to say, it looks like you're going to get shocked.
Yeah.
Which maybe that's what they were going for. Super fast.
I have to wonder, though, if, like, they've run this through the EU, like, their whole European certification stuff.
Yeah.
Because that warning symbol, I just don't think it's going to fly. Or that the Thunderbolt. It's, for everyone at home, or if you're listening, it's a little like lightning bolt with an arrow thing on the end. But it looks very similar to the electrical warning Thunderbolt.
The danger high voltage wires or whatever.
But I guess it's cool. It's 10 gigabit, which is pretty high.
10 gigabit synchronous, too.
Yeah. And it allows a couple of neat things. It supports display port connections and simultaneous PCI Express connections over it, which I'm not really sure how that all works, how PCI Express... I mean, I know PCI Express is serial as opposed to the old parallel normal PCI, but I don't fully understand how they interleave a data bus connection, because those tend to need to, like, need synchronous...
Well, I think it was a very similar thing to, you know, the hacking that made DSL. You have a phone line and you can now do voice and internet over the same line. These people have figured out how to do, you know, display and data transfer over the same line.
Yeah, it's crazy to think of PCI Express like out over an external bus, because it's an internal bus. I guess it's just that part of it sort of threw me for a loop. But part of me wonders, like, do we really need such a high bandwidth connection? I mean, progress is great, but most hard drives can't even flood a normal USB 2 port or a FireWire 400 port, let alone 10 gigabit connection.
Yeah, here's what I think, and this just comes from watching the video demo that Intel did with Apple. And this was back whenever LightPeak was still using fiber optic when they did the demo. Now it's all over copper. But either way, it's still the same speed. And the demo they did was they were driving dual displays, super high resolution, higher than 1080p resolution displays, and at the same time transferring like a 2 gigabyte file, you know, from one machine to another machine via LightPeak or Thunderbolt now.
Uh-huh.
And so I think what this is used for is not us. You know, even though this comes on the new MacBook Pros, if you buy a higher-end MacBook Pro, you get a Thunderbolt connection. I don't think anybody's going to use it unless you're a video person. Like a person who edits video, you need fast connections to storage, and you're using dual cinema displays at super high resolutions.
Yeah, it says here, too, that there's native drivers and I guess that existing mini DisplayPort-equipped monitors are already compatible and can be plugged directly into this thing. I'm not sure how that all works too, but
yeah, I know they have like a breakout cables,
right?
You know, kind of like some other things. You might have a video port on, you know, laptops are notorious for this. You have one video port, but you have a breakout cable that gives you DVI components, whatever, out of one port. So they do have that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's I don't think this is going to be useful, at least now, for consumers. Maybe somewhere down the line, whenever all of our TV content comes across the internet and we're downloading Blu-ray size movies, you know, maybe a year from now we'll be eating our words, because the way we do stuff will just be so radically different. But as of right now, it's just kind of a nice to have if you're rich.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm not going to rush out and buy a new MacBook just to get this. No way. I bought my current MacBook Pro because it had a FireWire 800 port. I bought the higher end one, and I still haven't used the FireWire 800 port.
Well, the real reason to get that generation of Mac was the unibody design. And
that too.
And all that.
I mean, honestly, though, that didn't even make me want to buy it. I bought it because I thought I was going to get into video a lot earlier than I did, which, by the way, I haven't yet.
Yeah.
But that's why I bought the one with the FireWire port, because I thought, whenever I get to do video, I'm going to need that FireWire port. But now that I realize I'm not upgrading to Thunderbolt. So our next article from Geek.com talks about something that we kind of mentioned in passing a couple weeks ago. And everybody who has heard about Kinect probably has seen videos or read articles about people using the Kinect hardware to control PCs. People have been writing Windows drivers or Linux drivers to use the Kinect motion sensing capabilities to connect to their PCs and basically use as a mouse or keyboard another interface. Well, now Microsoft has got on board with that. And they're like, you know what? We see all these people hacking our hardware and trying to reverse engineer drivers. How about we just give you an SDK? So what do you think about this?
It's nice. I mean, I don't know why Microsoft would have ever had a problem with somebody, you know, just using a piece of hardware to do whatever they wanted to do with it. You know, like, it's not like where you had to like jailbreak the thing to use it. It just plugs in over like a USB port, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, oh, well, I just want to access the USB port it's plugged into and, you know, tickle its sensors and read its data, the data that it's getting, and see what it does. Well, but the SDK is nice. I mean, it makes it easier, obviously.
Yeah, it could have been like, you know, other companies that say, you know, this works for a gaming console. If you want this to work for a computer, we have another version that you have to spend another $200 for to make it work on a computer. So they could have done that because every other company does that all the time.
Yeah, they could have. I mean, it's nice that they're sort of embracing some of these things. What I wonder, though, is the SDK is probably, it's probably Windows-based, I'd imagine.
Yes, yes.
So, like, I mean, for anyone that wants to use it, it's going to be kind of worthless unless you're using, like, Visual Studio to develop in or...
Yeah, yeah. I kind of look at it this way. The people who are hacking this to work on Linux, they're smart enough. They don't need an SDK. You know, if you're using Linux and connecting up random hardware and trying to make it work, you pretty much know what you're doing. And I mean, the same thing goes for the Windows people too. If you're hacking this stuff on any machine and reverse engineering hardware to write your own drivers, you pretty much know what you're doing. You don't need an SDK.
Yeah.
But at least Microsoft is on board and saying, hey, we see you guys working this hard. Here, we're going to make it easier for you because we already have the knowledge for it. So I think this is awesome. I would love to hear from anybody who does Windows development and is interested in Xbox and Kinect, you know, if you're going to get one, if you'll use it. I don't own an Xbox. I own a PS3, so I will never have this in my possession to test out. But I would love to hear if anybody actually does that. So moving on, our last internet story, Ryan, I believe is yours.
Yeah, so on Reddit, there is a... I don't know if everyone's familiar with Reddit.com, but it's sort of a news blogging site, I guess, or news gathering, social news type site.
It's a dig/dot similar kind of site.
Yeah, similar. So a couple of days ago, they had an AMA from the IBM Watson research team, and they didn't do a live AMA, really. Like, I think they just said, hey, ask us anything. And by the way, an AMA is ask me anything. Like, so there'll be an AMA request go out, like, hey, you know, we wanted a firefighter to do an AMA so we can ask firefighters like questions, or a policeman or a police officer or a developer for such and such. So they wanted to ask the Watson team stuff. So they responded and they said, hey, here's our AMA, ask us anything. And then they answered some of the questions. So it's pretty neat. They, basically go over some of the algorithms, a little bit of like how it would approach the problem to solve them, and its strategy for seeking out daily doubles, and like they talk about whether or not Watson had an unfair advantage with the buzzer, and they sort of support all the questions or answer them, and you know, support their position. So it's pretty cool. I'd recommend checking it out.
Yeah, and it looks like a different person answers each question. Am I reading that right? In the parentheses at the end of the question, was that the person who answered it or the person who asked it?
No, I think the parentheses is the person that asked it.
Oh,
because
okay.
These would have been people posting the questions to the AMA.
I gotcha.
And then I think they took time to develop responses because the responses are pretty thorough for the most part.
Did anything in there really strike you, something that you didn't think of before the last time we talked about Watson?
Well, one of them that I thought was really interesting is somebody asked if Watson could do an AMA himself, which I think would be pretty cool. So they're talking about they don't really think that they're going to like support that because it's really just designed to play Jeopardy, but they're working with Columbia University and the Maryland School of Medicine to apply Watson technology to healthcare problems.
Yeah, so that's cool. That was one of the things we brought up last week where we think Watson would really shine.
Yeah.
And they're definitely moving forward with it.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Very interesting. So definitely check out blog.reddit.com, and you should be able to find in the list of articles the title of the article was IBM Watson Research Team Answers Your Questions. And there are a lot of questions and a lot of good answers. 14 questions, and each one is very thoroughly answered. So our next article is kind of something sad for those of us who don't use HDMI ports for our movie watching, or maybe we just have a TV that doesn't have them. For those of you who continue to use component video to get your HD content, because we all know that component is still the analog method of getting 1080p video, you're not going to be able to do it anymore. So basically, they're doing, Hollywood is doing two things now. Newer models of, you know, DVD players will not have any analog video outputs. Not going to do it. It's going to be digital only so that they can maintain that HDCP encrypted loop. However, in addition to that, they will also be adding what's known as an ICT flag to Blu-ray movies. And basically, once you put the Blu-ray movie in, it will run a check to see if the output is going over analog. And if it is, it will downgrade it to 540p, half the resolution of HD, which you would have normally gotten. So either way, people who are using component, they're screwed.
Yeah, actually, I think it's even worse. It's like 480i, is what, isn't that what it is?
Well, it says it down-converts the videos 1080p native to 960 by 540.
Oh, okay.
Which is 540p.
That disagrees a little. Somewhere else they mentioned that it'd be limited to 480i. The other thing, I think they can still include component, but the component can't have the capability of doing HD. They have to limit the analog component to standard def.
Yeah, so either way, the whole point of this is that you're not getting HD over analog anymore.
Right.
And that's...
The interesting thing is that they have that flag, though, that they're able to disable existing players with this flag.
Right, yeah, so a lot of newer movies will probably have this flag. So right. Even if you don't go buy a new machine that has these things disabled, a newer movie will do it for you.
Right. Well, there's another part about this too that I don't think they really talk about that's long been a concern of the, you know, home theater enthusiast crowd, and that is that those that jumped on the bandwagon and bought even the early TVs they didn't have HDMI, they had a DVI port, much like your monitor. And I don't know how many people realize this, but HDMI and DVI ports are electrically compatible.
They're the same, pretty much.
Yeah, they're just, it's a different connection, a different physical connection, but at the electrical level, they're the same. So when you buy a DVI cable that converts from DVI to HDMI, it's really just it's a different connector, that's it.
It puts the wires on a different plug on the end.
Exactly. Yeah. But many of those early DVI TVs didn't support HDCP, which if they turn this image constraint token on inside the new movies that are released, this could actually break those that are using HDMI out on the DVR, but not on the TV side with the DVI connection, because the image constraint token will enforce that the HDCP connection be encrypted, and then it won't work.
Right, whenever the DVI connector, you know, can't maintain that encryption.
Right.
That's it.
Well, it's not really a function of the DVI itself. It's just that the TV would not have had HDCP built in.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I guess that's what I was trying to say in a roundabout way. If your TV has DVI, it's not going to support that.
Most likely, yeah. Now, some of the more modern TVs or ones made around the time of the switchover, they might also have a DVI in addition to HDMI. And, you know, it'll probably still work, because if it has an HDMI port, it'll most likely support, almost definitely support HDCP. But another thing this will break is if you're using a computer monitor as a screen for your Blu-ray player. If you have a computer monitor with a DVI port and you use a converter
cable,
you're screwed. Yeah.
Yep. Got to use a HDMI. So, those of you who are still using component, you might want to switch to HDMI. And we have to point out that this is really only for... The reason they're doing this is because of people ripping videos via the analog loophole, which is that once a signal comes out of a device, it has to be unencrypted so that your eye can see the correct image. So by hopping onto that, you know, the output by either, you know, splitting the cable and running it into your computer or something, you get the unencrypted video because it has to be unencrypted to be shown on your TV. So that's the analog loophole, and people are doing that to rip their Blu-rays and make copies or you know, normal people make copies, but the bad people, you know, sell them or put them up on BitTorrent. But that's the reason this is all happening, because of that analog loophole that people are, quote unquote, stealing content. So, yeah, upgrade to HDMI if you can. If you can't, luckily most TVs have good upconverting, in that you won't notice that much of a degradation of your image. If you get that 540p or 480 image, it'll still be watchable. But yeah, starting in 2014, you know, newer DVD players not going to have analog outputs.
Nope.
So, not cool. So, we have a bunch of articles, and we're not going to go through them one by one because each one only has a minor point about this whole process. And this is going back to the George Hotz versus Sony. Basically, him getting sued for jailbreaking the PS3 so that he can do homebrew. And the first thing that I thought was really interesting, on his personal site, he put out a request for donations. And the reason being, you know, Sony has a gajillion lawyers, and they're coming at him with all of them. And he has one, and even that one he really couldn't pay for. So on his website, he put out, you know, a request, if anybody can help, you know, donate money to help me pay for more lawyers so that I can have a proper defense against Sony, that would be great. And the first day I saw it, there was a PayPal button there. You could click on the PayPal button. It was at the very top of the page. You could donate. The next day I went back, the PayPal button was gone. And there was a message, thank you so much for all your help. Things are looking up money-wise. Expect to see a few more lawyers on my responses. So that is really cool that, you know, all of the people came out, donated to him. He now has money for a proper defense. And so what do you think about this before we go on? Just the fact that, I don't know how to word this, but that he, you know, he put out the request, he needs money for lawyers, and the world came to his aid.
Well, I mean, there's no shortage of people that support, you know, what GeoHot's doing. And I don't think, you know, in today's, the internet's, you've got a powerful platform when you're popular or you're a media icon sort of on the internet, you can raise a lot of money. So it's not surprising. I think it's, you know, I read the one post, the legal trouble one, and from geohot.com, and, you know, he has some interesting things in there that I really, you know, that I didn't know what some of the things that Sony are doing that just seems completely illegal. So,
yeah, it's definitely a good cause, and I hope he comes out on top of it. But some further developments in this case, we had first thought, because that's pretty much what the judge ruled, is that Sony would get all of his hardware, his PlayStation, you know, any computers that he used to do the development work, and they would be the ones to go through it to determine what he did and how he did it. Well, that was actually overturned whenever, you know, in our next article on Grok Law, they point out that he now has to give his computers to a neutral third party. So, you know, plus one, Sony doesn't get all of his equipment to do their own malicious things with it to, you know, they would probably show him in a bad light. They might say that they found stuff that they didn't find, twist some words, whatever. But now a neutral third party gets it. And what I find interesting from our next article from Grok Law, and if you're looking through the show notes, I actually started using a site called Awesome Highlighter to highlight the parts of the article that I found interesting, which is even helpful for me going through talking about it. And apparently what Sony was trying to do is to get that neutral third party that has his equipment to look through and search for other quote-unquote relevant materials. You know, the article from Grok Law says they were impounded for another purpose, Hotz argues, and once they are returned to him on February 28th, he can just provide answers to written discovery, interrogatories, and other requests. So it appears that Sony was trying to get this neutral third party to say, you know, we know you're only supposed to look for things specific to what we're suing him for, but why don't you go ahead and look for some other things just so we got some more stuff on him, see if he's doing anything else bad. And this article points out that there was a big disagreement on that. Can you believe that Sony's doing something like that? Like,
well,
this?
I know. Sony doesn't have a very good reputation when it comes to this sort of stuff. You know, with with their root kit that they had years ago, and you know, suing people, you know, suing 12-year-olds and grandmothers on their music division, which I guess is really through the RIAA. But, you know, it's just like, come on. I mean, I really don't think that people like Geohot and are really a threat to them.
Yeah, and especially, I mean, we watched the video a couple Slongcasts ago where he said, you know, he put forth effort to make sure that piracy wasn't an option with his jailbreak. Like, he's literally not trying to do anything bad.
Yeah.
And Sony is still trying to make him out to be a villain. So one thing that's interesting, which you may not know, is that there are actually two lawsuits happening at the moment with Sony. One is Sony suing George Hotz for his jailbreaking. The other is a class action suit against Sony because they removed the other OS functionality, which is basically what, you know, he was trying to put, what George Hotz was trying to put back in, give you the opportunity to do stuff like that. So we have mentioned before on another show that in a recent update, Sony removed the other OS functionality. You can no longer install Linux or any other OS on your PS3, and now there's a class action lawsuit against them for that. And basically, Sony's response is that, you know, we can pretty much do whatever we want, and to show this, we have a warranty that shows we can do whatever we want after that warranty expires. So let me read you a two quotes real quick from Sony's defense. So here is the quote from their lawyer in this case. "Well, Your Honor, a manufacturer's obligation for anything having to do with the product itself is only defined by by its express warranty." So now this is commentary. If Sony had said, "We guarantee that the other OS function would be supported. We guarantee PlayStation Network access will always be available. Anything about the duration, plaintiffs might have an argument. The only thing Sony told anyone about the duration of any feature on the PS3 is what it said in the 1-year express limited hardware warranty. It said 1 year. This is Sony's argument, that whenever you buy a device from Sony, you have that 1-year warranty, and after that 1 year, they are free to break your device, and you have no legal recourse, because they are only promising you what the box said that device would do for 1 year. If they want to take away your PlayStation Network access after 1 year, they can do it, because the warranty says 1 year.
Yeah, I mean, they may have a point on the network access because it's their service. They can determine who's on and off the service. It's their, you know, they provide the service.
They can determine it, but I mean, you agree to an agreement, and they can only take it away if you violate that agreement. You know.
Well, they can change the terms of the service. I mean, that's something
companies do that all the time.
Right. I think in terms of the service that they have a point. In terms of removing the functionality for it to run another OS after the warranty, I think that this doesn't hold water, that it's based on the warranty, because I think really what you said sort of speaks to that, is that they would essentially have the freedom to break your device. It could be considered malice, like, or malintent,
right,
to, you know, to break the device after the warranty's up. Like, I mean, no one's going to stand for that, and I don't think a well-educated judge is going to stand for that either. So they may have a point on the network, the PlayStation Network, but not the second OS stuff.
Right, yeah. And further down in the article, the second part that I have highlighted is the issue of vertical privity. So let me do a little preamble to that first. So basically, the plaintiffs argued that, you know, if you buy a toaster, the box says it's a toaster, it's going to toast bread, you expect when you take it out, that's what it's going to do. That can never go away. You bought it. It's a toaster. That's what it's supposed to do. The company can't disable that. And they are arguing that on the box, whenever he bought it, it probably said, now I don't know this because I don't have his box, but it probably made mention of the other OS feature, or the ability to act as a computer in addition to a video game system.
Or at least the manual stated it,
right,
as such.
Right. Something stated that. And now that is no longer an option. So the lawyers argue vertical privity is a prerequisite in California. This is the Sony's arguing against that. If you are an end user and you bought your console not directly from Sony, but from some Best Buy or whatever, you can't sue over the breach of these warranties. So basically they're saying is that none of this matters. Warranty, you know, forget about it. What it says on the box, forget about it, because you need vertical privity, which basically means if you didn't buy your PlayStation directly from Sony, you cannot sue Sony for anything that you find wrong with it. So,
well, that's fine. I mean, basically it just changes the class action that they'll have to file against Best Buy.
Really?
Well, I mean they could do that.
But how is that even close to being right? Best Buy has nothing to do with releasing patches that disable features or anything.
Well, it's kind of like I'm not a lawyer and I don't know the law that well, but I've
Yeah,
heard,
let me say I'm not a lawyer either.
Yeah. I've heard of even like people locally, like friends of friends that, you know, have had a mishap where they were injured by, say, you know, some kind of tool at their place of work. And in order to get, you know, and maybe the tool was defective, but because they were using it at their place of work and the tool was sold through a supplier, that they actually had to sue up the chain. They had to sue their employer. Then obviously that goes to court. The judge says, well, they have no control over this. They've acted in the best interest of the employee. There were safety procedures, but this tool was obviously defective. Then they, so that it gets thrown out, but essentially now you can sue the person above them. Like you could sue the supplier of the tool. And then once they get vindicated, then you can finally sue the manufacturer of the tool.
So basically you as the person who was wronged have to be in court for years to sue multiple people up the chain.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's efficient, but I guess it rules out, I don't know, I guess there's some indemnity or, you know, aversion to the liability that you get by selling the product through a retailer, you know, that Sony doesn't have to be in the business of retail if they don't want to. You know, there are things that come along with being a retailer versus a wholesaler.
Right. And this makes me wonder, because you can buy stuff from Sony at SonyStyle.com.
Yeah, you can.
However, Sony has so many different names. Like there's Skia, Sony, I don't know what that means, something of America.
Oh, Sony Electronics Corporation of America.
Yeah. And then there's just SCE, which is Sony, I don't know what it means, but, you know, there's SCEA, and then there is SCE. And then there's Sony in the music industry. Like, Sony has so many company names that maybe Sony Style is not under the same company name as the ones who make the PlayStation 3, that even if you did buy it from Sony Style, you still wouldn't be able to sue them because it's not the same company.
Yeah, if it's a separate legal entity.
Right.
That's probably the case. It's probably a separate legal entity. It's a wholly owned subsidiary or that sort of thing. They can do that sort of stuff. And I mean, these companies do that to reduce their liability, but, you know,
Sony seems to use it more to their advantage than other companies do.
Well, right, but I mean, that's why they do it. I mean, that's why the companies do it in the first place.
That's why our legal system sucks, because stuff like this can happen.
There's definitely things that I think you know, when you trade cold hard cash for a product, you know, there should not be a built-in, I think any kind of built-in obsolescence. Like, and I'm not, computers are obsolete in a couple years. I don't even consider that built-in.
Oh, that's definitely not built-in.
That's not built-in. That's just the way the world works. But built-in obsolescence in the sense that, like, the computer actually slows itself down over time.
Or something stops working.
Yeah. I mean, maybe you could say that about, like, you know, older Windows computers and, like, defragmented or fragmented hard drives, but there's a way to repair it easily.
Right.
You know,
you can always reformat and reinstall.
Exactly. Or defrag or whatever you need to do. There's nothing built in about that degradation. Some products that they do degrade, like that just the way it is. Like if you buy something made out of wood, the wood only lasts so long, you know, like,
I don't even think that's built in.
It isn't. No, I guess you're right. It's not even built in. Even cars, they wear out, but they're, I mean,
that's normal wear and tear.
Yeah,
on a product.
Right.
You know, this in the case of the PlayStation is not normal wear and tear.
No, there's no normal wear and tear associated with it. I think they They absolutely expressly changed an advertised feature midway through, and that is not right.
Yeah, and if you scroll down further in the article, they go on the I forget the words, plaintiffs and defendants, which one's which, but whichever one George Hotz is, he goes on to say, basically, that Sony hacked into his machine. So let me read the quote so you can see exactly what that says. You know, I've got an ownership interest in my computer and my hardware and what I have sitting on my hardware drive. So if somebody hacks into my computer, they have literally made an unauthorized intrusion. Now, this is Sony's lawyers. I'm sorry, this is Sony's lawyers arguing. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about if you are so interested in keeping this one feature that you're not going to be able to access the PlayStation Network anymore. You may not be able to play some games. But that is not hacking into somebody's computer, which is the essence of the CFAA, which is a previous legislation. So, you know, George Hotz is saying they basically hacked into my device and removed this, and they're saying, no, 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 you can't use this law that says, you know, about hacking because this isn't what we're doing. Do you think that it's the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act? I'm sorry. That was further up in the article that I blew past. So do you see hacking terms in any of this? Or at least some, I mean, it's definitely not hacking. There wasn't somebody at Sony sitting there in front of a terminal directly connecting to his device to remove a feature. So it wasn't that kind of hack. But do you see any terms of hacking here?
I don't know. This is definitely like sort of landmark in a lot of areas. This, you know, because I don't think it's hacking, but it's similar to the whole rootkit thing where,
well, they also called it unauthorized intrusion.
Yeah. You know, and there's a lot of new law that's going to come out of this. And I think this is similar to, like, you know, Apple being able to disable apps and things like that. There's a lot of law where, you know, things are happening behind the scenes without the knowledge of the user, and they paid for a service and a product, and they're not able to use it in the fashion that they intended. Like, you know,
for the time period that they intended.
Right. Like, here's an example. Now, this is pretty wacky, but let's say I buy a car, and the car is advertised that it runs on roads. Okay. And, but one of the places I go with the car is from, you know, you can go from point A to point B or point B to point C, but I use it to go from point D to point E. And it doesn't expressly advertise that you can go from point D to point E. But if for some reason they put some thing in the car and the car won't even turn on when it gets to point E or point D because of like the GPS or something. It's a reach.
So you're driving through Pennsylvania, you get to the Ohio border, and your car shuts off.
And the car shuts off, okay? Because it's not allowed to run through that area. Like, in my opinion, that's a similar thing. They've changed the car such that it can't do something it was able to do before that wasn't expressly said but implied, in the sense that, oh, it's a car and it can do this. So they sold you a PlayStation. It's implied, based on what they advertised, that it can run operating systems. Like, because people were putting Yellow Dog Linux on it a lot.
Yeah, right? That's the main version that people put on, yeah.
Right, you know, so it was advertised as that, being able to do that, and then that ability was removed. So I think, you know, that I think that analogy holds some water, but I don't know about direct hacking, you know, but there's no consent.
Yeah, I think calling it an unauthorized intrusion is more along the lines, because you say hacking, you kind of think of, you know, an evil person trying to break your stuff, but unauthorized intrusion is more along the lines of what they're saying happened and what Sony is saying. No, that's not at all what happened.
Does it bother you all at all that that so much of the media, including the tech media, even myself sometimes, we misuse hack?
Oh, yeah. Because, yeah, for those of you who don't know, hack just means to make something do something that it wasn't intended to do. Like, that's all hack means.
Yeah.
DSL was a hack. Somebody took a phone line and made it carry data along with voice. That is something that the phone line was never intended to do when it was invented. DSL was a hack.
Yeah.
You know, hack does not mean an evil person breaking your stuff.
That classically, that's cracking. There were always three major terms like hacking, cracking, and freaking.
Right.
And hacking obviously was just, you know, working on a computer to make it do something for you that it didn't originally do.
Right. Like, so technically any innovator was a hacker.
Yeah, any innovator on a piece of electronic device or computer is a hacker. If you innovate with the computer, if you make it do something new, that's a hack.
Yeah. Thomas Edison was a hacker.
Yeah.
He made copper wire, you know, short out an electric circuit to produce light.
Yeah.
Like, that's a hack.
That's a hack. But, and you know, cracking would be breaking in, and freaking is when you do hacking and cracking on a phone system, which isn't really big anymore. But
yeah, used to be big with like those voice dialer box things you'd hold up to the phone to get the correct codes.
2600, man.
2600. So just keeping up with the PS3, apparently Sony has started making their first PS3 bans, banning people on the PlayStation Network. So they have started to do that. We don't know yet whether or not this is because of jailbreaking, whether or not this is because of piracy, whether or not it's because of both. We don't know why, but Sony has started banning people, and you get the message when you try to log on to the PSN. You cannot use the PlayStation Network with this account, and they give you an error number. And in addition to just disabling people's accounts, they've actually raided a guy's house. There's an article from psgroove.com. Police raid, I'm going to butcher this guy's name, Graf Ciccolo's house. This was a guy who was working on the PS3 hypervisor, which is basically, you can basically say it's, you know, a dump of the code so that you can figure out how to jailbreak and stuff. But cool thing about this, the guy, you know, said that if anybody tries to do anything to me, you know, if Sony tries to sue, if somebody tries to arrest me, whatever, if anything bad happens to me, I will upload all of my work to the internet so that other people can continue it. His house got raided. He uploaded all of his work to the internet. So Sony cannot be happy about this, that the entire PS3 hypervisor and process that this guy used to, you know, reverse engineer the PS3 is up for free on the internet. It's actually linked in the article from PS Groove that anybody can go download. I wouldn't, because I don't want people coming to my house and arresting me for downloading it. But if you're a PS3 developer, you can do this. I think this is pretty cool. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know what type of legal trouble he's going to put himself in, because it's a little bit like sort of like blackmail, or
it kind of is.
You know, like, yeah. Oh, you can't come get me because I'm going to do something that'll hurt you. Or extortion, I think, really. Maybe. Something like that.
Well, he's not asking for money or anything. It really can't be extortion. He's just kind of saying, you know,
I guess it's just blackmail.
Don't hurt me.
Yeah.
And this is kind of opposite of what George Hotz was doing. Hotz wasn't releasing any of his code or the base code of the PS3. You know, he was just releasing the jailbreak process, you know, the executable to circumvent the sandboxing. Whereas this guy, you know, if you download this, you pretty much have the code to the PS3. That's pretty much what it is, for all intents and purposes. So,
I guess technically it's just coercion. He was trying to coerce them.
Yeah, pretty much. And apparently it didn't work, because they came after him and they raided his house. But, apparently some people have found out how to hack the PS3s. And, after the PS3 root key was released, you know, after George Hotz found everything out, the jailbreak came out, the root key got out. Now people have figured out how to hack some games and just get tons and tons of trophies for the games that they're playing. So this reminds me of the hack that somebody did to Second Life, where they made it rain Sonic rings. Do you remember that article?
No.
Do you remember, do you know what Second Life is?
Yeah.
So the 3D world Second Life, somebody made a hack to it where when you ran it, it just started raining the rings from the Sonic game. Whenever you would get the ring, it would be like ta-ding, ta-ding, ta-ding. And they just made it rain millions of these rings in the Second Life game. That's kind of what this reminds me of, except, you know, in Second Life, that didn't harm other people by giving you a better score at anything, whereas this does. You know, you're basically giving yourself all of these trophies for all the games you're playing. And I don't know. I think Sony has a lot to deal with. They have two main court cases going on. They're raiding people's houses. There are people out there actually using this code for bad, hacking the PlayStation Network and hacking games. this is going to be interesting to see how this all ends, because there is a crap ton of stuff going on.
Yeah, I don't know how you fix it, because, I mean, the only reason these game networks are popular or will stay popular is if they don't allow cheating. And it's hard to do that when you have hacked hardware.
Yeah, pretty much every video game that I've ever played online, the multiplayer, you know, version, they've had some sort of software built into it that prevented you from running cheat codes and stuff and auto-banned people who ran cheat codes. I forget what the software was called, but when I would play Rainbow Six and Ghost Recon and those first-person shooter games, they would always install this extra piece of software. I never knew what it did, but it was the multiplayer software that detected cheating.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and especially if you have hacked
hardware.
Like,
technically, you could still circumvent
that. And people did.
Yeah.
But if you have hacked
hardware,
this is going to be different. But you asked, how do they fix that? Well, our next article from IGN says that Sony is trying to develop a hack-proof PS3.
Isn't that impossible?
Yes. If you have the hardware in your physical possession, you can hack it.
Yeah.
Period. Like, that's how anything works. Physical access, it's game over. So unless they want to make a PS3 that lives in the cloud, I don't see how they're going to be able to do this. But the anonymous insider says Sony is already deep into plans of developing the hack-proof PS3, and this is mainly due to the recent leaks of Killzone 3, which the pirated version came out before the game came out for sale.
I guess it's possible. Like, could they not? I mean, if they develop the software, if they only let's just start from like the outside of the box. If the only way to hack it is if you have a way in to the box. So like if they limit the ports to the controller ports and like Ethernet, they design a good firewall that prevents any type of like hacking through the firewall. Then, and in addition to that, make the box such that if you open the box, it like basically destroys itself. Like maybe they build it so that like it literally cracks the hardware so that the hardware is then unusable.
That is pretty much the only thing they would be able to do, because you know Motorola had tried that eFuse technology that if people jailbreak it bricks their phone, people got around that. You know, if you have any sort of input like controller ports, people have found ways to hack through controller ports to access code. So Sony would be smart to not put code on a hard drive, something that you could take out and put in another machine. So we can assume that code is going to live on ROM chips.
Right.
However, there are people who will desolder ROM chips, plug them into their own ROM chip readers, and figure the code out.
Right.
So yeah, unless you do exactly what you said, which is literally break the hardware itself, snap it in half.
Like if, you know, like it comes to mind, like if they would like sort of embed the whole thing in like an epoxy so that if you tried to break the epoxy apart, that it would just like just render the hardware. I mean,
acid inside of it.
Yeah. Or it would more than likely render the hardware unusable.
Yeah. Like they would literally have to destroy it. You know, we all know the only way to destroy data on a hard drive, you know, magnets, the NSA can still get that back. You literally have to shred it into a gajillion pieces. So, yeah, something like that is what they'd have to do.
You know, this makes a strong argument for that. We looked at that article a couple weeks ago of the remote gaming, you know, where they...
Right.
You know, like where the gaming hardware is actually in the cloud.
And just delivers the picture.
Yeah. That may be the future of gaming if things...
I sure hope not, because then that means you have to have an internet connection. That means your device has to be connected to the internet.
Yeah.
You know, what if I want to take my device somewhere and play? I should be able to do that.
Well, they could, you know, they could maybe download the game states temporarily to like a VM or something.
Yeah, give you a cache copy.
Yeah, like that blows up like after you, like once you try to do anything, you know, sort of self-destructs in memory.
Can you imagine how bad or how mad people would be if they get a cache copy of their game, they're playing offline, and then all of a sudden the time limit expires, it blows up, and their 20 hours of gameplay didn't get synced back to the cloud, and they have to redo it all.
Well, I mean, they could just design it so the VM just pauses and then like it maintains.
Okay,
a state
so you can't
something.
Play until you sync back up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sony's got a lot to think about.
Yeah.
So enough about Sony. That was a lot about Sony because they got a lot going on. They are evil people, my personal opinion. So our second biggest story of the week is something that is going to happen tomorrow, and I believe it is tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern time. And that is, there is an event Apple is holding that everybody thinks is going to be the new iPad. Why do people think that? Well, because the invites that went out pictured the iCal icon, says March 2, and the top corner is peeled down, revealing an iPad.
So it's probably an iPad event.
So
maybe they're just going to deliver it on an iPad.
Ooh, maybe the whole presentation will be done on an iPad.
Yeah.
Yeah, so everybody is assuming now that this is the event we all knew or we all assumed would come in the spring, iPad 2 coming out. And, you know, lots of rumors, front-facing camera, rear-facing camera, A9 processor, you know, whatever all the rumors were. But are you at all excited about this? I know we talk about tablets a lot, and you said you weren't interested in an iPad. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not interested in the current version, and mainly because it just lacks a couple features that I think it should have. And, you know, I won't go over all that stuff again. We always talk about that. But,
right.
I'm really interested to see how they, what the price, I don't care if the thing comes out tomorrow or if it actually like is available tomorrow or it's not available for a couple months. What I'm really interested to see is what their pricing scheme is going to be. That's really what interests me with Apple anymore, is the price points, because the price points that Apple are making now are starting to set the standard for the industry, which is a huge change from 5-10 years ago.
Right.
I think that's the biggest change that Apple's had on the industry, and that's that they set the price point for this tablet market.
Yeah, I think there's one thing that we can say for certain, because it's the way they've done with every device ever, is that when the new device comes out, it will be at the same price point that the old device was at. So we can assume that that's going to happen.
Yeah, it may be maybe a little cheaper, but
they could go cheaper,
but
right.
Probably no more expensive, or not outside the threshold of like inflation. Like, you know, maybe like, you know, maybe it's 5% higher or something.
Yeah, and I don't even think they're going to do that, because that would be odd dollars. You know, like when they come out with things, it's $399, it's $699. You know,
well,
they,
I mean, right
they generally
now, the,
don't,
right
don't,
now the top line one's like $829. So
is it really?
Yeah.
Oh wow, I thought it was like $799 or $899.
No, I think it's $829.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I think so. I think it'll probably go up to like, if it went up, you know, like say it went up like 4%, it would be like, you know, $869 or something, but. I don't see it. I think they could ask a little bit more for it.
You're right. The Wi-Fi versions $499, $599, $699, but the 3G versions $629, $729, $829.
Yeah. So $30 to add the Wi-Fi, basically, right? Or $130 to add Wi-Fi.
$700 to $830, yeah. So
yeah,
$130.
$130 to add Wi-Fi.
Or 3G.
I'm sorry, 3G.
Yeah.
So. But like I said, the price point, and here's my prediction. I don't think we're going to see a whole new line of iPads. I think what they're going to do is, and this is how they'll get you. Like everyone thinks, oh, I don't want to buy that $499. What's the cheapest iPad?
It's $499.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want that $499 iPad with the camera. I'm going to wait till the one with the camera comes out and buy that one. I can tell you right now, I'll put $25 again. I mean, if you want to bet against me.
I want to hear the bet first.
Actually, let's just say I bought a beer at Toulon's.
Okay, beer at the Southside.
A beer at the Southside that the bottom line iPad, when they announce it, will not have a camera.
Are you talking about the bottom line in the entire iPad line?
Yes.
Or the bottom line of the new ones that they're revealing tomorrow?
The ending iPad line, like the ending line of iPads offered on the store after this announcement, like,
okay, so you're assuming that they're going to do what they did with the iPhone. The iPhone 4 comes out, you can still buy the iPhone 3GS at a cheaper price,
right?
So you're saying that when the iPad 2 comes out, they're still going to be the same price as they are now, but there's going to be a cheaper model, which is the original iPad.
Yeah, I think you're going to get an original. You'll get an original high end iPad for the cheaper price. Like, maybe they'll do, instead of doing 16, 32, 64, they'll do 32 and 64 with 3G, okay, on the lower two ones. And then the higher two ones will be like 64 and 128 or something I don't even know.
And those will be the iPad 2s.
Those will be the iPad 2s, and they'll have cameras and all the extra features. That's my guess. Something similar to that.
Crap. I don't want to take... I'll take this bet. I don't want to because I think you're absolutely right.
Well, if you think I'm right, you don't have to take the bet.
I mean, because this is what they do with the iPhone. When a new one comes out, they still keep the previous version in their lineup, and it's cheaper, half price, whatever.
Yeah, it obviously is the first time this has happened for iPads, so like... And we, like you said, we've seen it happen with iPhones, so I don't think I'm really going out on a limb here.
Yeah, I think you're pretty much right.
But that's my prediction, because I started thinking about it, you know, the other night, and I'm like, yeah, I've been holding out because I really want to get one with a camera, if I get one. You know, but I think in the end, that one with the camera is going to probably be closer to, you know, on the high side of $500 to $1,000 versus the low side of $500 to $1,000.
Well, see, I disagree with you there. I think that the iPad 2 with the camera, front and rear, the lowest model iPad 2 is going to come in at the $499 price point, which is what the lowest model iPad 1 is at now. I think that's where the iPad 2 is going to start, the current iPad is.
And then you think the current iPads will be even cheaper?
Will be $450 or $400 cheaper than $499.
See, I don't think that's a, my bet is that the, so maybe we should take that back, because I really do think that the lower two ones will be the same price as the lower two right now.
So you're saying the price is not going to change for the current iPad. They're going to remain the same.
No. What I'm saying is that they're going to take the two higher iPads, the two highest iPads they sell
right now. Oh, and make them cheaper.
And make those cheaper.
Okay.
But they'll still be the same price point as the iPad.
Okay, so let's take this bet then.
Okay.
A beer at the South Side. So you're saying that the more expensive iPads will now take on the price of the current iPads.
Right.
And I'm saying that the current iPads will be cheaper.
Okay, yeah, that's a cool bet.
Okay.
I like it then. All right.
Okay, let's see what happens. So we won't have to wait long. You know, tomorrow they probably won't announce this until 2:00. They always, if something starts at 1, they always do the, and one last thing at like 1 till 2.
Right.
So yeah, after 2:00, we'll know tomorrow.
Cool.
So let's move on. We have an Android story, and it's from TechCrunch. The title, despite 861.5% growth. I didn't read that wrong. The Android market has grown 861.5%. Despite that growth, Android market revenues remain puny. You might think, how in the world is this possible? Well, there's a table on here that shows how that's possible. So let's keep with the percents. So sure, in the 2010 growth year, the Apple App Store only grew 131%, whereas Android grew 861%. That seems like Android should be crushing them. But in total share, Apple has 82% of the share. Android market has 4.7% of the share. So that's still percents. You still might not know what that means. So let's look at the 2010 revenue column. The Apple App Store is, I believe this is in, this is in millions. 1,782 million. So I believe that is 1,782 million. So if the table says 1,782 and that's in millions, that would be $1 billion of revenue. Whereas Google Android market only has 102 million. So the Apple App Store is like 17-fold in terms of revenue higher than the Android market share. So this kind of comes as a shock, because didn't we have an article a week or so ago that kind of put Android in some terms higher than every other marketplace? I forget what that was, or if I'm even remembering this correctly. Like, didn't we have an article that said the Android market overtook every other market in some manner?
Maybe in like one of the quarters. I mean, or something like that.
I forget what it was, but I remember having an article that Android like completely overtook everybody.
I think it was just in sales, like not market.
Okay. Yeah. So now that we have this table, we see, you know, for the entire year of 2010, that Android is actually fourth.
Yeah.
You know, Apple is first, BlackBerry is second, Nokia Ovi Store. What is that?
I don't even really know.
Well, some people must, because it's number 3 at 105 million. In 2010, and Google comes in fourth at 102 million.
What I find the most telling about that table, though, is, I mean, Apple lost 10% market share. That's huge. Yep. I mean, the market probably grew rather than they obviously didn't lose any sales.
It was just kind of dilution, really.
Yeah, because, you know, their revenue still went up, you know, went up 100%, if not more, like 100 and change. So, you know, there's they've grown, but in terms of market share, I'm sure Apple would rather maintain the 92% market share.
Right. Yeah. So what this kind of shows is that from 2009 to 2010, the number of people with smartphones grew by a crap ton.
Yeah.
And all of them went to not Apple.
Right.
Because Apple lost percentage. So that shows that, you know, in simple terms, they didn't get any new customers. We know they did, but we can say that they didn't because they lost a lot.
Yeah. I mean, look at it this way. They more than doubled the revenue, but still lost market share.
Right.
That's, you know, interesting, I think. That means that the market in itself is growing at a very rapid pace. You know, and the other thing about this table that's interesting is where BlackBerry AppWorld sits. I was surprised at this. I didn't think the AppWorld was as popular, but it's still beating out the Google Android market by almost a factor of 2-1. And the AppWorld isn't even all that old. I mean, even though BlackBerries are old, the AppWorld's fairly new. And they're beating out, you know, they were beating Google out 3-1 before that. So they're still maintaining a healthy lead on Google. Which I just think, all things considered, is surprising with BlackBerry.
Yeah, and I don't think it's quite as surprising as you. I mean, actually, I do, because my reason for that was going to be I've recently been seeing a lot of BlackBerry commercials on TV. They are targeting the high school crowds, you know, the high schoolers who are texting their lives away. I shouldn't say it like that. They're texting a lot. They are the people who text message the most out of everybody. Largest texting demographic. So BlackBerry has tailored their commercials, their TV commercials, toward them in that, hey, come to BlackBerry. We have this thing called BBM, the BlackBerry Messenger. And you can get on it and you can text all you want and it's not going to cost you anything like a texting plan does. And look at how cool it is. Here's features that text messages don't have. I've honestly been seeing a lot of BlackBerry commercials recently that specifically try to sell BBM. They're not selling phones, they're selling the BlackBerry Messenger. And but I retract that from earlier because that didn't affect the 2010 share. You know, those have just been recent commercials. But I do expect to see BlackBerry jump up more because of those commercials. I think a lot of younger people will be going toward BlackBerry more than any other device because of the BBM feature, which, you know, like you, current and older BlackBerry members knew how awesome it was. But nobody else knew that unless you bought a BlackBerry and found out firsthand. Now BlackBerry is showing you on TV, hey, check this out. So now a lot of people are going to check it out.
Yeah, and here's just an interesting tidbit about this BlackBerry versus Android, which is kind of the real battleground right now. I mean, like, everybody, you know, poses up, you know, that Android's going after Apple. And I think they are. They want to be the king.
I think everybody's going after
Apple. But they got to really put a stake in the heart of BlackBerry, too, because BlackBerry's still a competitor. They're still there. But here's an interesting tidbit. So the BlackBerry App World was launched in 2009, April 2009. October. Where did I just saw that a minute ago? Oh no, April 2009 is right. And the Android market was launched October 2008.
Really?
So the Android market has...
It's older.
It has six months or more on BlackBerry, and in terms of its availability to users, but yet BlackBerry is still beating them in revenue.
Well,
so,
here's one difference in that. Sorry to interrupt you, but...
That's fine.
Whenever the Google market came out, Android was pretty much only on the Nexus 1. Like, there was one phone, you had to buy it directly.
The G1.
The G1.
On T-Mobile.
You had to buy it from Google.
Yeah.
So even though they came out before, there was like two people in the world that had the phone.
Yeah.
When BlackBerry App World came out, there was already a huge user base.
That's true. They did have the advantage of their user base. That's a good point. But nonetheless, I'm sure Google's is not happy with this, the fact that they're still trailing RIM. you know, on these things, especially with their market growth, you know, in terms of the actual handsets.
Yeah, and that's something, that was a point I was arguing today with people on my Facebook page. We were actually arguing a different point, but one of the points that I brought up while arguing my main point is that the Android percentage of people who have Android phones is going to grow exponentially just because Android is now quickly becoming the quote-unquote dumb phone OS. So people don't even know they're getting Android when they buy a phone. It doesn't even have to be a smartphone anymore. It could just be a more enhanced feature phone, and right. It's coming with Android. And more phones are going to do this. So kind of just by default, Google's share of people with Android phones is going to grow exponentially. And I think that's also going to help their market share. And in that terms, do you really think it's a fair game?
Because, well, I do, because, you know, now AT&T is offering the iPhone 3GS for $49. You know, I mean, there's almost no difference between an Apple, an iPhone, and a dumb phone, you know, in terms of price.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think I don't know if we'll see that on Verizon, because I really doubt that they would make an iPhone 3G CDMA version to sell on Verizon.
Yeah, I doubt they'll do that.
That would be silly.
And why would they do that when the iPhone 5 is going to come out in 3 months?
Well, that, yeah, they'll have something to demote eventually.
Right.
So, but yes. It's interesting, you know. I mean, I was really surprised at the revenue that Apple is pulling in on that.
Yeah, I had no idea.
I actually went and checked it. I didn't believe it. I was like, no, that has to include.
I saw you typing away while I was saying this.
No, actually, I checked this last night, and because one of the reasons one of the things I was wondering is like, oh, maybe that App Store revenue is including songs, because
total iTunes revenue.
Right. I was having a hard time, you know, getting that. Finding stuff that separated that out, but I did check their earnings report, and total sales through iTunes was $4.1 billion last year.
So this is like 25% of their sales.
Yeah.
Wow.
And in addition to that, they had growth in the music sales business too. So, I mean, the thing about this, here's the thing about the App Store, and I think really Apple is just turning into a large, they're basically like Best Buy, Staples, and all that combined. They're a storefront now for applications. So, I mean, yeah, they're going to make money on this.
I will agree with you. However, unlike all of the other storefronts for applications, they're the ones who make it the easiest. And I think that's what put them there.
Well, I think BlackBerry App World is just as easy to use. I don't even think about it, you know, like you have to log in just like you do with the App Store from or the Apple iTunes App Store,
right.
And you know, it's the same sort of thing. It's simple to use. I mean, I don't know that their App Store offers much over anyone else's App Store.
Yeah, I've personally never used an App Store on any other phone, so I can't say that.
Yeah, and one of the things that was interesting, you know, that Android had well before Apple did, or the iPhone had, is that you could buy something on your computer on the Android market, and it would push it to the phone, you know, over the air.
Right. You don't have to sync.
Right. And I don't know, is that still not true of Apple?
I don't know of any way to do that.
I know the iPad, you can buy stuff, download over the air.
Well, you can do it from the phone.
But not from the computer.
But you're saying, from a remote, if you leave your phone at home, at work, you can log into the BlackBerry App Store, purchase an app, and when you get home, it's on your phone.
Yeah, Android.
Sorry, yeah. Android. Yeah, that's, you can't do that. With Apple, you buy it in iTunes, and you have to sync to iTunes to get it transferred.
If you don't buy it over the air.
If you don't buy it on the device itself.
Yeah, so that's an interesting difference.
Yeah, there's no quote-unquote pushing of purchases.
Right. So
yeah,
anyway.
That would be nice to have.
Yeah,
I would definitely like that.
I think they implemented that through an API that they call Intent. Like, there's an API that Android has.
Yeah, because we talked about that with the hacking of the phone. They have the software install Intent, and that's what people used. Google used to disable that one guy's application.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Trojan. But yeah, I think that's a good thing. I think that's where Apple might have to go, because now they're making MobileMe accounts free. So they're making it so people automatically get cloud storage.
Yeah.
So it seems like they're going toward that not syncability, I don't know how to say that, but
yeah, I mean, if you think about it, the iPhones still aren't really, and the iPads really aren't like cloud capable totally. They still rely on the PC.
Yeah, they still rely on the cable and the syncing.
Right, and what as long as they have that, they're gonna force PC sales. You know, like, and there's, I never think if that's the case, they're almost like keeping like if iPads and iPhones end up being 90% of the market, they're gonna keep Microsoft on life support because people are not gonna switch. If Microsoft doesn't innovate and people buy PCs for other reasons,
right?
But or get themselves into the mobile or tablet market, then people will still buy PCs because it's what they know. They're still the largest market leader, and I don't think Apple's going to get people to buy Apple PCs because it's such a big switch in people's heads for most people. Plus, they're more expensive. Well, most of them are, except for like the Mini.
The Mini. Yeah, so you want to hear a confession?
What's that?
One of the main reasons why I bought a Mac computer is because I wanted an Apple product to sync my iPhone to. I bought an iPhone before I had an Apple computer.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I did not want to sync this thing to a Windows machine. So I did not sync my iPhone until I bought a Mac because I've heard horror stories of Windows iTunes screwing things up. I'm like, this phone is not touching a Windows machine.
Yeah, I've never had any trouble with the syncing process in my iPod, but the Windows versions of iTunes are, I mean, I think there's, it's honestly, I think it's just iTunes itself. It's super slow.
Well, they keep adding so many new quote unquote features to
it. Yeah, it's just, it's
bloat.
I can't, like, you look at everything Apple does, and there's some people who have commented on this. They can't believe that Apple still puts their trademark and their name on the iTunes product.
Because it's not an Apple product.
Yeah, it's so crappy. I mean, it's just,
it goes against everything that they've ever done.
Yeah, it's not simple to use. There's stuff buried in menus, like
all the menus.
It doesn't, and obviously if you're coming from the Windows environment, like, you know, they put like the kit to like the settings for the program, it's under like preferences and it's in a weird menu instead of like tools, which is typically, tools is typically the place where like options and settings are in a Windows app, but in Mac it's like something and then preferences, so it's like hard to find.
Yeah, on Mac. Well, you always have the top bar.
Yeah.
Whereas on Windows, you don't have that. But in the top bar, for every application, the first entry is not file. The first entry is the name of the application.
Yeah.
And under that is where preferences is.
Well, see, on the iTunes, on the Windows for iTunes, preferences is in some other menu.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So.
So let's move on. Enough talking about Apple. We had a story last week about Apple. So I guess we are talking about Apple a little more. About Apple taking their 30% cut on subscriptions, like magazine subscriptions that they would be offering on the iPad. And there's an article now from Tuow, which is a T-U-A-W, the unofficial Apple weblog. Tuow. And it says that Amazon probably doesn't care about Apple's whole in-app purchase forcing and the 30% cut. And it goes on to explain why. And that is because Amazon is developing a web version of the Kindle Reader, which you can run on an iPad, and it will implement pretty much all of the features of the actual application version. So I think this is genius. And I think every magazine, not manufacturer, but anybody who offers magazines for a subscription might actually go to this method. HTML5 web apps that are as full-featured as the native apps. So any comment on that?
I mean, in some ways, this is where Apple could shoot themselves in the foot. You know, way back when there was a lot of talk about them being a closed system.
There will be no SDK.
HTML5. Yeah, they're like, oh, there's two ways to interface with our computers. You can do it our way or you can do it HTML5. And they may have like wrote their own death sentence with that because they may have pissed everyone off enough that they'll not use the SDK for not develop for the App Store. Instead, they'll develop for HTML5.
Which will work on every device.
Right. And the problem with that is that then Apple has no control over it. They have no revenue stream from it. And if they take the feature away or limit it, they're going to look really bad.
I totally agree.
So they may be at a, you know, at a point now where it's like, maybe we should rethink this whole thing. I don't, I mean, they're probably not. They're making money hand over fist. And they've, the whole company's made enough money that if they went bankrupt tomorrow, probably everyone would be happy, you know, if they could just, you know, sell what they have. But
new feature of the next version of the iPad. You know how Safari did HTML5? We're giving you back your beloved HTML4. That would be interesting if they downgraded. They would never do that, but that would be funny. That would be a good SNL skit.
They could turn into Sony and start pulling features away.
You know what? If Sony wins these court cases, it's a free game.
Yep.
Any company can do that. Our last topic of the day is basically the major and only competitor to Skype. Facebook has come out with Facebook Messenger for the iPhone. It is an application that you can put on your iPhone, and it works from iPhone to PCs as well. It's not only iPhone to iPhone, but it is Skype. I mean, it's not the Skype code base, but it is video chat. It is a direct competitor of Skype. The benefit is you don't need your friends to have a Skype account, which probably 99% of your friends don't have. All you need is a Facebook account, which everybody has.
Right.
And you open up Facebook Messenger, click on one of your friends, ask them to video chat, bam.
Well, hold on 1 second. It's not video chat. It's just VoIP right now. They may integrate video at some point.
Okay, I just assumed that was in this release right now.
No. No, so it's right now it's VoIP. It's the VoIP part of Skype that it's going to compete with.
Okay.
And they're saying that this could leverage Facebook's network to leapfrog the front of the competition, especially if it can integrate video in future iterations, which, I mean, that's not a stretch.
Yeah, really.
If you can do VoIP audio, you're halfway there. Like, audio is probably the most difficult part. No one really cares if a video is a little bit choppy, right. But they want smooth audio. So I think if they get there with the voice part of it, you know, video can follow. And I think the problem they'll have with video, though, is won't that compete with FaceTime? And then would that give them trouble on iPhone? Because I don't even think Skype does video on iPhone right now.
Yeah, it does.
Oh, it does?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, if you watch a twit every once in a while, some people will be remote locations and they'll have to use their iPhone.
Oh, okay. So it does do that.
Skype does video. So that's a good point, though. But if Skype does video, then I can see them allowing Facebook Messenger to do video also. Like they can't have one and not the other.
Facebook's a much bigger threat to Apple than Skype is.
Yeah, but you can't do it. I mean, there's a precedent now. You can't allow one and not another.
They've already, what do you mean? They've done this for a lot of things. Allow one and not allow another.
Really? Like what?
They get a lot of different people get special treatment.
Yeah, there are those special treatment cases.
They're usually big organizations and stuff.
So, Facebook's they make some money.
Well, I know. I mean, I don't even know if that's even been proven yet.
Well, that is true.
they're supposedly worth a lot of money.
Yeah, they make fake money at the moment.
Yeah.
But I can see Facebook being one of those companies that gets the special treatment.
They might.
And their app gets allowed. But I mean, forget about FaceTime for a second. I think if Facebook Messenger takes off with voice and audio, Skype goes away. Because really, what is the benefit to Skype? There is no benefit anymore. Because everybody is on Facebook, nobody is on Skype.
Yeah.
You know, so
it could be just, I mean, it depends on what Facebook allows, like international calling and everything else. And there's things about Skype that are advantageous because you can call, like, you can
Skype
call
out.
Landlines, and landlines can call you if you get a Skype number.
Yeah, I think my personal feeling on this is that Skype's only option now is to let Facebook buy them. Because really, the majority of their business will be given to Facebook once Facebook Messenger does video. So that is our last story. Ryan, did you have anything you saw happen this past week?
Yeah, actually, I had a couple interesting stories I just wanted to touch on. So I saw this one where AMD has a video. Well, first of all, AMD has a new processor technology coming out. They're calling it an APU. I think that stands for Advanced Processing Unit, or I'm not sure what APU stands for.
I have no clue.
They're calling them an APU. It's the Llano. It's L-L-A-N-O.
I think it's Spanish. Llano.
Llano. I think it's Spanish. I don't know. So it's their
Baxter, you know I don't speak Spanish.
Yeah. It's their, they're calling it the fusion architecture, which I think people probably have heard of the fusion architecture. It's been around for a little while. Like, I mean, at least the name. But this is slated to be released soon. And they compare this new Fusion APU against the new Sandy Bridge Core i7, which I guess that new Sandy Bridge includes video processing on it now.
Yes. Yeah, they've integrated.
Right.
And it's the accelerated processing unit.
There we go. And this new Fusion APU includes AMD Radeon graphics. And they have a nice video where they demonstrate high quality 3D rendering, and the processor's power consumption. So they have the video and they show side by side how fluid the video is or the rendering is, and then also the consumption. And they point out a couple things about how the power consumption is really smooth and steady on the AMD unit, and it's jerky on the Intel unit. And then they also demonstrate it with an Excel application running on top of that, with the video still running smoothly in the background. The Intel processor continues to get more jerkier. And then finally they add in a video playing with video enhancements turned on. So on the Intel side, the video is just playing. It's HD video. But on the AMD side, they're playing the video and doing enhancements to the video while it's in real time. So this could be considered like if you were doing like video editing.
Like real-time effects.
Yeah, type thing. And it handles these tasks, seamlessly. The machines are pretty similar. They have a C300 128-gigabyte SSD for drive, 4 gigabytes of 1333 DDR3 RAM. They're running all the res graphics at 1366 by 768. And the only really difference is the processor and the graphics unit that's in the processor.
Right. Yeah, the chipset, basically.
Yeah. So they've tried to get them as close as they can. And AMD seems, on the surface, looks to be spanking their butt with this technology.
Yeah, I think this is, 2002 all over again?
Yeah.
When AMD was out front of Intel, and then Intel kind of took over again, and now AMD's like, hey, look at us.
Yeah, a friend pointed out a couple things. One, that the thing that's always killed AMD is their idle power consumption, which has made their chipsets like virtually useless in a lot of portable applications. Like, they're used, but they're not good at battery life. Which I've seen some stuff elsewhere that they may be improving on that, like at least be getting acceptable on some of their mobile solutions. And the other problem, I guess, is that, it's not really a problem. It's just that Intel has never taken a good stab at graphics. So it's not surprising. And AMD's had world-class graphics. Bought ATI.
Yeah, that is true. Anytime somebody mentions Intel graphics, you always think, oh, that's the crappy onboard graphics. Turn that off.
Yeah.
Like, that's what immediately comes to my head when somebody says Intel graphics.
Yeah, but it's impressive. I mean, I don't know about you. Like, I don't know if you've done many machine builds in recent years, but I've done two for myself. One was a home server and one is a home theater PC. And I've gone to using motherboards with integrated graphics, and both of the ones that I've picked have AMD, Radeon on board. Now they're obviously in the North Bridge. They're not, or actually they might be separate chips that connect through the North Bridge.
Right.
But they're, I don't even know for certain how that's laid out. But anyway, they're integrated into some extent. And I've been really, really happy with the performance. And I don't do a lot of gaming, but I've tried gaming on them just to see, and it's acceptable. And they get pretty high scores in like the Windows benchmark. The Windows 7 benchmark.
Yeah, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's what these are geared toward, is they're moving toward the gaming market, not necessarily the normal PC, everybody needs to have this market.
Yeah, I think they're targeting this Fusion chipset at like the the budget gaming sort of market, I think, is where I'm not 100% sure about that, but it'll probably be priced there because there'll be certain things that it's not good at, as always with AMD. Like, there's some benchmarks that are just terrible, and maybe on the benchmark arena they might be lower. I've always been really happy with the performance of my AMD chipsets or CPUs. And I'm always rooting for them. I'm definitely an AMD fanboy when it comes to that. But I own an Intel laptop as well, and I mainly went with Intel because the power consumption is a lot better. So anyway, I just thought this was really cool.
No, I definitely agree. I honestly, right now, I only own Intel machines, but back when I built machines, I only built AMD machines.
Yeah.
You know, now that I have mainly laptops and I don't get to choose, you know, you get what you get. But
yeah. And then the other thing that I saw today that is kind of interesting is that they recently announced that Microsoft is axing the Danger service for the, if everybody remembers, the Sidekicks on T-Mobile.
Ooh, the Sidekick.
Yeah, so I guess officially May 31st, Danger's going away.
And so, that was interesting. I didn't realize that the Kin was supposedly the rebirth of the Danger service. And yeah, that was axed a long time ago.
I just don't think there's the price, the market, you know, it's so compressed price-wise. There's really not any room for a device that's almost a smartphone.
Yeah, what do they call it? Social phone or social device?
Like that Motorola Click, I don't think that did real well.
No.
I mean, even though it was really a full-featured Android phone with a social layer, it just wasn't super popular.
Yeah, I think the people who want social connectivity on their phones also want other stuff, and they're probably not happy with only being able to make calls and hit Facebook. They want to do other things. So that's sad. Microsoft axing the Danger service.
Bye-bye.
Although I think it's a good move, though.
Yeah, they need to focus on Windows Phone 7 and
yes,
and all the good things that are...
And fixing that bubble interface.
Yeah.
So that is it for this week's edition of the Slongcast. As always, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. Ryan, where can people find you?
You can find me on lancipedia.blogspot.com. I always mess that up.
It's hard to say whenever you're trying to say it fast.
Yeah, and try saying it like five times fast the next time.
No, thank you.
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/RyanLancy.
Very cool. And as always, if you want us to talk about a story that you found interesting over the past week, just bookmark it on Delicious. Next week's episode will be episode 26, so bookmark it Slongcast 026, and we will make sure to talk about it, and we hope you guys have a wonderful Tuesday evening.